Okay, as I mentioned earlier today in Shir, Yom HaTzmaut is a day that even outside of Eretz Yisrael has some format and structure. Everyone celebrates it one way or another. I hope and I trust that you had a level of intensity and engagement that you don't have in Chutz Laaretz being here for Yom HaTzmaut. But certainly Yom Yerushalayim is a day that I gather in Chutz Laaretz is far more abstract, far less engaged in, and this is really an opportunity to sense why this day is so important and why people invest a dwindling number of people. This is really a holiday that's become very diminished in the Israeli consciousness. You can go to any major city and it's a regular day. Secular Jews don't celebrate Yom Yerushalayim to any great degree. Obviously, Haredi Jews don't celebrate it. Even within the Dati Lumi community that you'd expect there to be a greater awareness, it has dwindled. It has become very much the province of yeshiva boys and yeshiva girls and the Tilumi people that have the ability to take off from work. But even if you don't celebrate it or experience it by taking off from work, it's only a day that across the world people are noting and acknowledging it and possibly reading a machzor about it. But either way, I just wanted to try to outline three of the layers of Yom Yerushalayim that aren't obvious to most people. The first layer is, I would say, a layer that in no way relates to Yerushalayim, Har HaBayit, to the Kotel, everything we're going to talk about in Mitzvah Shem, the Shabbos, and Yeshiva. It just has to do with the fact that a war was waged that imperiled the entire state of Israel, could have led to a national calamity, and Baruch Hashem, not only was disaster avoided, but we triumphed. Namely, it shouldn't even be called Yom Yerushalayim. It should be called Yom Milchemet Sheshet Hayamim. Let's assume for a second we hadn't liberated Yerushalayim. Let's assume for a moment we hadn't returned to Beit Lechem. Let's assume for a moment we hadn't returned to Hebron. In 1967, General Nasser, who was the military strongman of Egypt, evicted the UN from the Suez Canal, very famous move, united all the Arab countries, and hurled a very, very menacing threat at the state of Israel, which to this day people make fun of. It's a caricature. People write about it in news columns. But he was the one that coined the phrase, I'm going to march into Israel and I'm going to hurl the Jews into the sea. Today you have all these cartoons. What does it mean to hurl people into the sea? Okay, guys, here are sheets. Okay? Hey, see, I'm sitting in the sheets. The guys are coming a little late, okay? And today it's laughable because Baruch Hashem, we have a strong nation and we can rebuff all strategic threats to our sustainability. But in 1967, the threat was legitimate. People really feared the Holocaust. You don't have to, I guess, just to bunch up a little bit. This was 19 years after the state was formed, 22, 23 years after Hitler was suppressed. Those intervening years in Israel were not robust years of economic prosperity or military superpower or international engagement. Do you even know that in the 50s there was severe ration? You couldn't just buy meat in Israel. In the 50s, you had to stand the line, get your kilo of meat for the week, and that was it. Diplomatic isolation. This was before the United States poured heavy weaponry into the state of Israel. Those were very, very lean and difficult years, pockmarked by multiple battles and wars of attrition that you can read about. Just simple Google wars of attrition in the 1950s. So when General Nasser says in 1967, I'm going to hurl the Jews into the sea, people take him seriously. And for those who came in a little bit late, I'm trying to carve out an identification for Yom Yerushalayim, independent of recovering Yerushalayim, and independent of returning to Yudan Shomron. Just the military victory was itself reason to celebrate and to say hallel. Just the Yeshua. Do you know that men, women, and children were actually sent home to the United States, to England? People feared a disaster. The role of a general is to war game for every possible scenario, as remote and unlikely as it seems, ahead of time. So then the heat of battle, when it's hard to think carefully and clearly, you'll have every option covered, then you can implement plan B, plan C, plan D. So when a war general, when an army general sits in the weeks and months leading up to war, you have to scheme for every potential scenario, as remote as it may. Israeli generals, the chief of staffs, didn't even war plan for liberating Yerushalayim and fighting in Yerushalayim. And unfortunately, that's why it's become such a political hot potato, because there was no plan for this, what to do with lands that were recovered. This is a war of survival. There were no bomb shelters. People had to descend into bomb shelters makeshift basements underneath apartment buildings in Tel Aviv, because if you're on the second floor and it gets bombed, you'll die because the floor will collapse. If you're in the basement, so the floor will collapse. If the bomb hits here and you're here, you'll survive. If the bomb hits here and you're underneath it, you'll die. It's a 50-50 chance. But it's better than nothing. Weeks and weeks before the war began, children would come to school, and first-hand reports of this. Read Tehillim for 5 hours and go home. No courses, no lectures, no homework. People feared a calamity. The generals were struggling. How can we escape this war on two fronts, the Syrians and the Egyptians? Before, there were no allies. No one was helping us. How could we escape this war with our country intact? We know we're going to have to suffer, chas v'shalom, 80,000, 120,000. Remember, this was a 2 million strong nation. 100,000, 200,000, maybe 300,000 fatalities, but how can we survive? This was doomsday. We look back at it, the war is undergoing historical revision. This is about pure survival. And people were legitimately frightened. There's an old joke that I still heard when I came to Israel. And in 1967, the prevailing line was, you may have heard it, the last one to leave Ben Gurion should shut the lights out. Basically, people envisioned the entire process grinding to a halt, the country being overrun, at a certain point, surrendering to the Arabs, closing this Zionist experiment after 19 years of glory, but unfortunately, it didn't succeed sufficiently. The last person to leave shut the lights. That was a real joke. I mean, it's a joke, but it was a real sense of this may not be sustainable. So when you say, Hodu Hashem Ki Tov, Ki Le'olam Chasdo, Sunday morning, when you dance in Mitzvah Shem Matzei Shabbos, for a moment, forget Yerushalayim, forget Beit Lechem, forget Gush Etzion, forget any of that. Just think about perhaps the greatest military salvation in thousands of years at a national level. Me'afela Li'ara. Mimaves l'chay, in a very literal sense. People descended into those basements the first night of the war and walked out of those basements day one hearing that there's no longer an Egyptian air force because they had been surprised and eliminated in an Israeli attack. That was incredible news. People were fearing widespread carpet bombing of entire streets in Tel Aviv. For months and months, we begged King Hussein, the father of the current King Hussein of Jordan, don't enter the war. We have no beef with Jordan. We have our hands full in the north with Syria and in the south with Egypt. Sounds almost anachronistic, almost like today Syria is a threat, Egypt's a threat. These countries are imploding in on themselves. Just to show you, Baruch Hashem, we don't take chas v'shalom any joy in anyone else's suffering. There's great suffering taking place across the Arab world. But one by one, the domino effect, unsustainable to governments, and Baruch Hashem, the last strategic threat to our country is Iran. Terror is not a strategic threat. It has to be dealt with psychologically, but it's great trauma, but they're not going to overrun the country with terror. But in those days, the Syrian army and the Egyptian army, buttressed by legions and legions of Arabs joining from other countries, represented a mortal strategic threat. And we beg King Hussein, don't join the war. This is not your war. And somehow that day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervened in his heart because General Nasser sends a telegram to King Hussein of Jordan and says, Egyptian tank divisions are marching on Ashdod and Ashkelon. Come join the war and you'll share the booty, you'll share the treasures of war. When in fact, Egyptian divisions were being encircled in Sinai Desert, about to surrender. But somehow King Hussein, what happened today? You check on your Twitter feed, you check on, for those days, King Hussein gets duped. And he launches his armies into the battlefield. And then within days, scenes that we can only imagine, dream of, Hayinu Kecholmim, the famous book, Harabayit Biyadeinu, Yishalayim Biyadeinu, Amdos Hayiragleinu B'Sharayach Yishalayim. Re-entering that phrase that I keep stressing to you, the corridor of Jewish history, stretching from Shechem and modern-day Elon Moreh, and the Yishalayim, and Malay Adumim area, and Beit Lechem, Gush, Marasa Machpelah, Chevron, this is where Jewish history evolved. Unfortunately, we weren't prepared for it. 2-3 days after we liberated the Kotel, Ariel Sharon brought in some bulldozers and bulldozed a few blocks of Yerushalayim and created the plaza that we now know to be so regal surrounding the Kotel. It used to be just a little dumpy alleyway in front of the Kotel. Had he not taken that immediate action, it would still be a politically hot and contested area. And fortunately or unfortunately, we weren't able to create that same dynamic in the area that we live in, and that's why it's become such. But don't let the lagging, frustrating, perplexing, internationally challenging situation revise your view of the war. This is a war of Yeshua. This is a war of survival. It was a war launched by the Israeli army, but every bit defensive just to fend off a looming, impending attack. I want to read with you a source that Rav Amital, Zichrono Livracha, would always read with us from time to time in Yom Yerushalayim. This is a story taken from Malachim Bey, source 1, in which the king of the northern kingdom, and as you know, the northern kingdom is divided from the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom contains 10 tribes, generally 10 tribes betraying, less committed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. And the southern kingdom of Judah, Yehuda, Binyamin, a little bit more committed. The northern capital is Shomron, the southern capital is Yerushalayim. So at this point, the king of the northern kingdom is Yeravam, but not Yeravam ben Nevat, who every schoolboy knows, the nefarious, wicked king. This is his successor, who goes by the same first name, Yeravam, interestingly. Yeravam ben Yoash. So the pasuk reads, Bishnas Chamesh Esrei, source 1, Le'amatziah. Amatziah is the southern king. Malach Yeravam ben Yoash. Yeravam ben Yoash is the northern king. What was he like? Well, the Tanakh is fast to supply that information. Vayas harabe ne Hashem, lo sar mikol chatos Yeravam ben Nevat asher hechti es Yisrael. This man, Yeravam ben Yoash, was just like his namesake. You can fill in the blanks. You know about Yeravam ben Nevat. Forced people to worship pagan idols, murder, the worst. According to one position in the Gemara Sanhedrin, Yeravam ben Nevat abdicated his share in the next world. So you're dealing with someone who is clearly, as we would say, off the grid religiously, and he takes after Yeravam ben Nevat. What happens during Yeravam ben Yoash's administration? Hu heshiv, line number 3, Eskivul Yisrael milavo chamas ad yam harava. He leads to grand territorial expansion. He extends the borders all the way to the Mediterranean Sea in fulfillment of Hashem's prophecy. Who was the prophet? Kidvar Hashem asher diber biyad avdo Yonah ben Amitai. The whale man. This is Yonah actually serving as a prophet, not just being swallowed by a whale. So Yonah had prophesied about territorial expansion, and Yeravam ben Yoash actually fulfills it, implements it. So obviously, the Tanakh senses there's a bit of a dissonance here. The evil, wicked king leads to such military triumph. What gives? What's the purpose? What's the reason? So the Tanakh explains. Source 1, 3 lines from the bottom. Ki ra Hashem mis'ani Yisrael morei ma'od. Hashem saw the plight of the Jewish people was bitter. Ve'efes atzor, ve'efes azov. Ve'en ozel le'Yisrael, no allies, no one to help us. Lo diber Hashem, l'chot Hashem yisrael matachas ha'shamayim. Hashem would not allow the Jewish people to be exterminated, the Jewish state to be terminated. These scenes literally describe 1967. No allies. No support. We went in it alone. After the 67 war, rated by 73, America decided. America was preoccupied with Vietnam in 1967. They're not pouring heavy weaponry into Israel. This was a laboratory to test some of their new weapons and the new war toys, but they were not heavily weaponizing the Jewish state. I'm sure you've driven to Yerushalayim and you've seen in our day they were actually less institutionalized, but you've seen those burned out tanks and those burned out, they still have the burned out cars. And they were just... And they're just like lying on the road. Now they have plaques and they're officially cordoned off. But we were actually drive to Yerushalayim and see in the 80s these tanks and burnt out cars that were just on the side of the road. And these were testaments to what type of sacrifice it took to drive to Yerushalayim between 1948 and 1967. Because there was such a narrow corridor and the Arabs could snipe at you from either a hill or a ravine. And to get close to the Kotel means you're opening yourself up to pot shots from Arab snipers, Jordanian snipers, near the famous Mandelbaum gates that everyone knows about, that is the closest you can get without possibly being exposed to gunfire and trying to look at the Kotel. The Jewish state was unsustainable territorially. The Jewish state was unsustainable economically. The Jewish state was unsustainable diplomatically, militarily. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu expanded our borders and saved us from devastation. And Rav Amital would always read this with gusto, and read those last three words, Vayoshiyem biyad Yeravam ben Yoash. So that day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's agent, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's malach, was a sinner. That day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's agent was a terrible king. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu can dispatch Yeravam ben Yoash as an agent of our redemption, He can certainly dispatch David Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky and Moshe Dayan and Ariel Sharon, and so many people have a difficult time processing secular Zionist leaders. How could they be agents of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's divine redemption? And Hashem chooses very unlikely heroes sometimes for whatever reason he has. In those days, in the days of Tanakh, Hashem chose Yeravam ben Yoash. Read those words, Vayoshiyem b'yad Yeravam ben Yoash. And no one in his right mind would even begin to compare Moshe Dayan and Ariel Sharon and Mati Gor. Mati Gor was a general who liberated Yerushalayim to Yeravam ben Yoash. These are people who are not patently committed to ritual in the classic sense, but their commitment to the Jewish people, to Jewish history, to God in heaven, are certainly far more advanced and progressed and committed than someone like Yeravam ben Yoash. So make a kal v'chomer, if a Kadosh Baruch Hu can redeem the Jewish people through Yeravam ben Yoash, he's certainly capable of redeeming them through Mati Gor and Ariel Sharon. Ariel?
No.
Right? Okay. I didn't mean to compare them by way of kal v'chomer. So before you even mention the word Yerushalayim, it's not Yom Yerushalayim. It's Yom Sheshet Hayamim. It's the day in which we celebrate the greatest military triumph in thousands of years. And the potential for annihilation and for calamity, for suffering was immense. It was very real. And somehow 40, 50 years of hindsight has blurred or obscured that recognition. And that's the first layer of Yom Yerushalayim. The second layer of Yom Yerushalayim is not just the military triumph, but returning to Yerushalayim. When I say Yerushalayim, I mean Yerushalayim in its environs, Yerushalayim in its surrounding areas, this corridor I speak of. Let me show you an interesting Gemara in Brachos. Again, Rav Amital would quote this from time to time. On Daf Mem Tes. Take a look at Source 3. At this stage in the Gemara is debating how the third bracha of benching, of Birchas HaMazon, should conclude. It's a bracha of Gula. Uvenei Yerushalayim Mira Kodesh Mirav Yameinu Baruch Ata Hashem. So one position says, Ma'u Chosem, our position, Binyan Yerushalayim, Bonei Yerushalayim. Tanakama, our Shita, Bonei Yerushalayim. Rabbi Yosi, Rabbi Huda, Omer, Source 3, no, you say Moshiach Yisrael. The bracha should conclude Baruch Atah Hashem, Moshiach Yisrael. At which point the Gemara leaps up in opposition. What? Let's get Gemara. Moshiach Yisrael in Binyan Yerushalayim lo? You're going to conjugate a bracha that talks about Yeshua, Moshiach Yisrael, and omit referencing Yerushalayim? That's impossible. It's impossible to discuss salvation and redemption without saying the word Yerushalayim. How dare you, Rabbi Yosef Bihud, to even posit, even suggest that option? Tanakhama says, Yiboni Yerushalayim. You're trying to discuss Gula without Yerushalayim? It simply doesn't exist. It's a ghost. The Gemara retreats. No. Rabbi Yosef Bihud says, I did not mean Moshiach Yisrael. I meant Eleima Af Moshiach Yisrael. I meant that the bracha should read, Bone Yerushalayim U'Moshiach Yisrael. That's what I intended the bracha. That the bracha should not just mention Yerushalayim, but should articulate the word Yeshua, rather than leaving it vague and implied. Takeaway from this Gemara is, there is no such process or dynamic of redemption and salvation without Yerushalayim. In 1947, Jews returning to their homeland, as historical as it is, and as joyous and as triumphant as those experiences were, they did not carry the redemptive connotations that 1967 did. For the world, Jews returning to Israel in 1947-48 meant that they could deal their conscience a cathartic closure, because everyone felt guilty for the millions of Jews that were murdered and mowed down in the Holocaust. Everyone was at their wits' end about how to house all these refugees as they were being transported from port to port across the world. So this was a convenient solution, practically and psychologically. But Jews returning to Yerushalayim, that means Jews are returning to the stage of history. That sends shockwaves throughout the entire world. For some people, it's very exhilarating. For a Christian fundamentalist, it's an omen that the end of time is accelerating. For others, it represents itself in hostility and opposition. It didn't exist to the same degree before 1967. But less than the public, supporters and opponents, the Jewish people returning to the Kotel and returning to Yerushalayim and returning to this corridor of history is an event of far more redemptive magnitude and dimension than 48 Jews returning to Haifa and Petach Tikva and Tel Aviv. And that's why history kicked into high gear in 1967. For some people, it marshaled and it elicited hostility and opposition. For some people, support. There's a very interesting phraseology in Shir HaShirim. In Shir HaShirim, as you know, it's not a soliloquy, but a dialogue between a male and a female. And the male is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the female is Am Yisrael. And they're searching for each other and talking to each other. Where can I find you? And have you seen my lover? And his hair looks this way, and he smells this way, and she smells this way. But there's a third group of people that enter into the conversation. Actually, there are two third groups. There are two subsets. One are the Shomrim. There's a constant conversation with the people who are guarding Yerushalayim. I'm actually going to talk about that this year in the Yimei Yun for Tanach in the summer. That's a topic they asked me to talk about. But there's also the daughters of Yerushalayim. Hishpati eschem benot Yerushalayim. So the male will turn to the benot Yerushalayim, but the female, I forget who, have you seen my, swear to me that you'll pass on the following information. Hishpati etchem benot Yerushalayim, a very famous pasuk, loads of you who haven't studied the four oaths, which form the cornerstone of Satmar's opposition to our return to Israel, because the Gemara in Ksuva says, Hashem made us take four oaths, basically not to return to Israel until we were beckoned by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So may we not spend Yom HaShoalim reading about it, learning about it. I wrote about it a little bit in the Machzor. What is our response to the four oaths? Who are these Benot HaShoalim? So they're typically referred to, as you said, the nations of the world. This is their literary, dramatic presentation. In every play, a person plays something larger than themselves. You represent a larger symbolism, not just yourself. Any classic Greek tragedy or comedy. Why are the nations of the world referred to as Benos Yerushalayim, the daughters of Jerusalem? Strange name. So the Yishalmi, I quoted a medrash for you, Source 5 says as follows. The word bat, daughter, biologically means your daughter, but figuratively means a suburb. Just like a daughter is a satellite of a parent, so suburb is a satellite, if you think of the areas you live in. So Woodmere, at least today's a central area, but it's a suburb of the city, so it's a daughter, it's an extension. Thornhill is an extension of the city center. So for example, when the Jews capture the big metropolis on the east bank of the Yarden, in Parshas Chukas, called Cheshbon, that was a large center area that had changed hands between Moab and Sichon, Melech Amori. So the Jews capture Cheshbon, Uvinoteha, Cheshbon and all of her daughters. Doesn't mean they're capturing the daughters of Cheshbon. They're capturing all these little hamlets and villages that sprout up and grow around the major urban area. So why are the nations of the world referred to as Benos Yerushalayim? So let's see how the Medrash explains. Source number 5. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Asida Yerushalayim lehasels metropolitan. One day Yerushalayim will be the center of the earth. L'chol ha'ratzos, and everything else, every other city will be a suburb. New York City, suburb. Beijing, suburb. Moscow, suburb. Every large city that people flock to, that people think are the center of the earth, everyone knows that history will wash into the basin of Yerushalayim. That's where the wars will be fought. That's where history will conclude. That's where the final chapters will be written. And at that point, that will become the center pivot of human experience, the epicenter of Jewish experience and by extension of human experience, and everywhere else will be a suburb. Oh yeah, you're flying to Tokyo, send regards to the farmhands. Oh, you're going to New York, say hello to the people living on the periphery in the suburbs. Like, oh, you're going to a suburb, say hello. So everything else will be called Benot Yerushalayim. This is a prophetic statement. And you don't think people realize this? All the opposition, and all the contentiousness, and all the dispute, it's because everyone realizes, subconsciously, that Yerushalayim is, not incidentally, the center point for all three world major religions, not incidentally a hotly contested land, and it's contested because people realize. I mean, you think the real estate skyrocketing prices in Yerushalayim is incidental? People know. People know this is a place that history will unfold. And getting a front row seat to history is a privilege, and a privilege people are willing to pay for. So when Jews return to Yerushalayim, that process denotes our return to the historical stage in ways that 47 different. That's when the mass aliyah began from so many countries. You compare the aliyah rates before and take a look at a pasuk you recite every day, but now that I can contextualize it and frame it for you. Source number 2, Bone Yerushalayim Hashem, Nidche Yisrael Yechanes. You see the juxtaposition between two different phenomena. One is the rebuilding of Yerushalayim, and one is the ingathering of exiles. So the return to Yerushalayim, and again, Yerushalayim is not just a city, but that center point along this corridor of Jewish history conveys a sense of historical inevitability and historical acceleration that 1947 and 1948 did not. I want to read a letter to you that was sent, and then team it up with another letter. After the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, so Yerushalayim ceased to be the epicenter of Jewish culture, the epicenter of Jewish experience. By and large, in the early part of the last millennia, certainly after the Jews were no longer in Yerushalayim, so many, many Jews were relocated to Baghdad, to Iraq, to Syria, that's where Chazal operated. But there's an equally large community in the Egypt center, not in Cairo, but Alexandria, that became a big Jewish community. And in many ways, it outlasted the epicenters that were established by Chazal in Iraq. And that became, for much of that millennia, Egyptian Jewry, Alexandrian Jewry was the center, pivot, or the center locale of Jewish culture and Jewish expression. So Chazal were already aware of this. Look at source number 6, how the people of Yerushalayim used to write letters. How many Jews lived in Yerushalayim after the Churban Beis HaMikdash? You could probably count them on a few hands. Jews have never completely left Yerushalayim. There have always been Jews living in Yerushalayim. But there have been periods in which the numbers of Jews living there have dipped incredibly, listen to what I'm about to say, even beneath 10. When the Ramban writes his famous letter after he visits Yerushalayim back to his sons in Spain, he writes a letter and says, I got there, I couldn't even find a minion. Can you imagine less than 10 male Jews living in Yerushalayim? So I can't imagine that during Chazal's era there were that few, but you're not talking about hundreds, maybe dozens, maybe a few hundred. So the people of Jerusalem are writing a letter to the Jews living in Alexandria. And they begin the letter the following way. Davar Acher, source number 6, Hayu b'nei Yerushalayim kosvin miYerushalayim ha-gidola li-Alexandria ha-ktana. The Jews of Yerushalayim are writing a letter from the great Jerusalem to the small hick town, redneck Jews living in Alexandria. If you compare the amount of Jews living in Alexandria to the amount of Jews living in Yerushalayim, it would be disproportionate. It would be off the charts. But Jews always have to have a sense that living in Yerushalayim, as sparse as it is, as isolated as it is, as challenging, means you're living in history and you are holding the fort. You're defending the fortress of history so that Jews can one day return. There's a scary, eerie tradition. It's written, it's told over, not written, in the name of the Sma. Those of you who are in my shir this year, we learned the Sefer Meir HaSinayim, one of the great commentaries on Chosha Mishpat, 6th, 17th century commentaries, late 16th century commentaries. Why do the German Jews throughout history always suffer so extremely, so tragically, compared to the Jews in other lands who obviously suffered persecutions, but it was always the German Jews who bore the brunt. In 1096, as the Crusades make their way towards Yerushalayim, somehow their route takes them through Spires, Magens, and Worms, right along the French-German border, and those Jews bear the brunt of the savagery and the brutality. In 1940, somehow Nazism arises out of Germany, and German Jews suffer. Again, all European Jews suffered, but clearly German Jews had it worse because they were imprisoned, they had limited resources for escape. My family, my mother's side, were German Jews. Essentially, they were completely annihilated. They couldn't escape. Only my grandmother escaped. So the Sma says something amazing, startling even. Evidently, Jews were exiled by Nebuchadnezzar. You're going back almost 3,000 years, or 2,500 years, to the first Beis HaMikdash. We assume, where were the Jews exiled to by Nebuchadnezzar? To Babel, to Persia, Mordechai, Esther, that whole area of modern-day Aziskan, Kazakhstan, that whole area of Pakistan. Evidently, Jews were also exiled westerly, and they made their way to Germany. Who was living in Germany 500 BCE? And then 70 years later, Ezra invites the Jews to come back from Germany and resettle Israel. And the Jews write the following letter to Ezra. They say, Ezra, you take the Jews back from Bavel to Yerushalayim HaGdola. Same words as the letter from the Jews in Yerushalayim to the Jews in Alexandria. And we will remain here in Germany because they've embraced us so kindly and so generously, we'll stay here in Yerushalayim HaKetana, mini Yerushalayim. The tradition goes, and it's not a tradition of folklore and stories, but it's actually quoted by the Svarim. Because they dare, they arrogated to call Germany Yerushalayim HaKetana, that condemned them to disproportionate suffering throughout the ages. It's one thing if you don't move from Germany. I'm not defending it, not justifying it, but to call Germany, to use the word Yerushalayim about any city other than Yerushalayim is an offense to Yerushalayim. Lahavdil, just because it popped into my mind, I want to make sure you get this message. I have zero tolerance for the employment of Holocaust terminology to describe anything other than the Holocaust. It is simply forget the intellectual dishonesty, it is disrespectful of people. Those terms are uniquely Holocaust. When people get up and call each other in the Knesset, it pains me. Nazi or Hitler or Nuremberg laws, it's just such a lacuna, such a myopia of Jewish history to take something that I remember in 2006, about 9 years ago during the expulsion from Gaza. And this is not a political statement of support or opposition, but a lot of the evacuees staged Holocaust-like scenes. They walked out, and they had the children walk out of the house with their hands raised. Or they staged destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash-like scenes where they carried the menorah to mimic the Arch of Titus. And I just felt like it was so obnoxious and so insensitive. You can't even begin to compare the voluntary relocation of 8,000 Jews by an Israeli government, as tragic as it may be. Compare that to 6 million Jews being hunted down like dogs in Europe, or to the Beis HaMikdash being burned. How can you even begin to compare that? It's such historical blindness and historical myopia and tunnel vision. So there has to be. I even have a hard time sometimes when there's this phrase that I find abrasive. I will never use it. I'm going to Australia for a Shavuot. So I asked, can we arrange a shir here, arrange a shir there? They said, well, we can have it on Yontif. And I said, well, does everyone live in the same proximity? Maybe we should have it after Yontif so people can try. They said, well, everyone lives in the ghetto. I have such a hard time when people talk about, oh, the ghetto in Toronto or the ghetto in South Africa. How can you use a term that is associated with such suffering and exploitation and persecution? I just can't use that term. It's hard for me to use that term. I think about the Warsaw ghetto. I think about the Kutna. I think about Jews suffering. So Yerushalayim is not a term, even mini Yerushalayim, that you employ about anything other than Yerushalayim. And the people of Alexandria had that sense. They didn't write back, how dare you. People of Yerushalayim, those 10 Jews, sent a letter from Yerushalayim Agadola to Alexandria Katana. And I want to share with you a letter that took place that was written about 100 years ago. But 100 years ago, I think I told some of the boys in my shir, Rabbeinu Meir Simcha was the rabbi in one of the greatest Russian-Ukrainian towns called Dvinsk. Which sefer did Rabbeinu Meir Simcha author? None other than what? Arsameach. And the Meshech Chochma. Meir Simcha Koi. Meshech Chochma. One of the greatest rabbis of the last part of the 19th century. Early part of the 20th century. So he was a rabbi in this hustle-bustle town of Dvinsk, and the Jews of Yerushalayim invite him to come be the rabbi in Yerushalayim. So I have the letter that the people of Dvinsk wrote to the people of Yerushalayim, basically saying, how dare you invite our rabbi, the great town of Dvinsk, to come be the rabbi of a couple of Jews in Yerushalayim. What are you thinking? Why in anyone with his right mind would a lead Dvinsk can be a rabbi in smelly old Yerushalayim? And now it's 100 years later, and who's living in Dvinsk? And what happened to Yerushalayim, Baruch Hashem? So sometimes we've lived there in greater numbers, sometimes we've lived there in fewer numbers, but Yerushalayim has always been iconic. I lived through the mid-90s, obviously, when there were great debates about the Oslo peace process and land for peace. And even those who were more practical in their outlook and said, we are willing to surrender land for potential peace, which in the current discourse seems almost laughable, but in those days was a real option. Yerushalayim has a special status. You can't just gauge practical. Let's divide Yerushalayim because Yerushalayim is iconic. Yerushalayim has symbolism far beyond just Jews living there or not. Is it our right to surrender Yerushalayim when it has such larger historical connotations? Some would say, look, you can't factor that in because when people's lives are at stake, you have to factor it rationally, empirically, not symbolically or iconically. Okay, that's an interesting question. But when we returned to Yerushalayim in 1967, 68, that was a game changer. It's a whole different equation. And that's what we're celebrating on Yom Yerushalayim. That's the second layer. It's not just Yom Milchemet Sheshet Hayamim. It's Yom Yerushalayim. In addition to this military, it's not like there's two different identities. It's a schizophrenic day. Two things happen, and each is so large, they collapse in on each other. It's hard for us to process them independently and autonomously. I want you to think about them. I want to separate them. Create a wedge in your mind as you experience this day. On the one hand, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Zeh Yom Ma'asa Hashem, Nagilah V'Nisim Chavav, you saved us from death. Mi'afeinu Liyara Hashiba L'Gula. Secondarily, Ema Barim Smecha HaLukah. The mother was sitting there smiling as her children filed back to their homeland. Ema Banim, the mother of the children, Smecha HaLukah. And that's the second layer. And then there's a third layer, which I can imagine you probably never even thought about, but ironically, is the one that's the most relevant to everyone in this room. I'm not teaching Israelis, I'm teaching overseas students. Why is it the most relevant? So let's share a source that I've heard interpreted in a myriad different fashion, but I want you to hear how I feel the Pasuk should be read or the matter should be read. Source number 8, the last source. Yerushalayim is referred to Ki'ir Shechubra La Yachtav, that everyone gathers and integrates and expresses solidarity. Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Ir Shehi Ose Kol Yisrael Chaverim. Very interesting medrash. A city that makes every Jew friendly. I mean friendly, like you're my friend and I'll have dinner with you. But it creates solidarity, fraternity, unity. What does that mean? Well, I can't tell you why, but I can tell you that. And I'll give you two examples. Everyone look at my hand. I want to make this visual for a second. Everyone look at what I'm trying to describe here. Imagine the core of Yom Yerushalayim took place in Yerushalayim proper and in the overall country of Israel and the surrounding environment of the military battlefield. So here is the core location of Yom Yerushalayim's events. But you see how my hands are rippling outward? I want to discuss with you the ripple effect. What happened here in the core, Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael, rippled easterly and changed the world, and rippled westerly and changed the world. What do I mean to change the world through its easterly ripple? The Soviet Union had all but eliminated Judaism from its Jewish inhabitants. I'm old enough to have met Jews from the Soviet Union who simply did not bear any semblance of their past Judaism. My grandfather emigrated from White Russia in the early teens, 1919, 1918, whatever, after the war. One of his sisters was stuck behind, and she remained in the Soviet Union. And I remember in the early 70s being visited by one of her children. So he was my generation, right, a little bit. No, he's a generation older than my father's generation. He sat at our breakfast table with his big Red Army lapel on his shoulder. He was visiting from the Russian Soviet Communist Party. I was literally shaking at the table. I thought this person was going to roll me over with a tank. I mean, there's not a Jewish person sitting at my table. He didn't seem to me to be one. He gave me a toy tank with a Russian emblem on it. I was a hit at school because everyone saw my Russian tank. The problem is a week later, the batteries ran out. So I opened the back to replace the batteries, but it was a Russian battery. So I couldn't replace it. I tossed the tank. That completely stymied and suppressed any trace of people's Judaism. You were embarrassed to be a Jew. You'd be sent to gulags. They had completely whitewashed. They completely cleansed and purged. And all of a sudden, Soviet Union Jews who have no sense of their Judaism are listening to the Voice of America providing reports of the Jewish army defeating all the Arabs and military victories and people dancing in the streets, dancing to the Kotel, Od Avinu Chai, Am Yisrael Chai. It is, in my opinion, one of the biggest miracles of the last 100 years to take millions of people who are frozen in history and thaw them so miraculously. And that led to 2 decades of great political struggle. That was my era. We used to go every Sunday in May to Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza in front of the UN. You think you guys are activists, probably Israeli activists. You just, with our signs and let the Russian Jews go and direct flights from Israel to Israel. This was our struggle, Russian Jewry. Do you know one of the whole milestones of the last 67 years in Israel? To me, one of the major events, and I've told this to you before, is the absorption of 1.5 million Russians in the early 90s. That is the event that transformed Israel from an economic mess to an economic superpower. Because our economy thrives on human resources, and we absorb 1.5 million incredible people. Ethiopian Aliyah did not advance our economy. Because unfortunately, they came from depressed lands, without skills, without education. Hashem, that's our responsibility as well. To embrace and to host and to retrieve every single Jew across the world. But by and large, the Russians who came were by and large educated, by and large civilized, not third world, first world, doctors, teachers, professionals. So it took a while for the country to recover from the convulsions and the contractions. But ultimately, that is what transpired. I was here in the 80s. You know how much a bag of milk cost in the 80s? You're going to laugh. 90,000 shekel. You'd walk into the makolet and they charge you 90,000 shekel for a bag of milk. Until the next day when you walked in and it cost 120,000 shekel. It was a joke. Money was a joke. Money was a complete farce. That's how terrible our economy was in the 80s. Night and day to the economy today. It's incredible that we've been able to sustain both democracy and economic sustainability in an era in which all the Arab countries around us are collapsing politically, and all the European countries that have sustainable and strong, robust political systems are tanking economically. And to be this little country without natural resources in the middle of a battlefield with lunatics aligned all across our border, and we have a robust democracy and a superpower economically. It's an incredible feat. It's a nace. Shows HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand, Yad Hashem. Those are the easterly ripples of the Six-Day War. This all began after the Six-Day War. Before nothing, millions of Jews were slated for historical oblivion. But there's also a westerly ripple that you people are all the products of. And I want you to appreciate that. A lot of boys and girls come to Israel for the year and legitimately question modern orthodoxy as a way of life. And I think that if you don't question it, then you may not be honest, you may not be dedicated, because not in all areas does it live with the fidelity and the commitment and the level of religious passion that we expect of each other and you should expect of yourself. And some people decide that isn't the approach that suits their future in Avodas Hashem. Some people decide it is the approach. Don't confuse modern orthodoxy with national Zionism. They're two very different phenomena. They overlap a lot. They overlap demographically. People that were once modern orthodox who live in modern orthodox communities tend to move to national religious communities. There's an overlap on Israel. There's general inclination to open to secular culture. But modern orthodoxy is primarily preoccupied with extending Torah to the overall culture, to the world around you. National Zionism, in theory, doesn't have to be concerned with that. National Zionism's primary occupation is how do we extend the spirit of Torah to build a state that's religious and to advance Geula. There's a lot of overlap, but the core is very different. But one thing I'll say. Every Jew today who's serious about their orthodoxy owes a tremendous historical debt to the modern Orthodox Jews of the 50s and the 60s and the 40s, who sometimes people ridicule because they went mixed dancing and mixed swimming and their orthodoxy was feeble and anemic. Why? Because in the 40s and the 50s, any sane-minded person assumed that orthodoxy was on the ropes and would collapse within a few generations, if that long. Yeah, a couple of old Jews from Europe, scattered refugees, battered and bruised, the Orthodox. But the new generation, the American, I don't think it's a melting pot. Everyone should conform. This is the great era of conformity. We're living in an era of personal expression. Twitter, those days, look at the television programs in the 50s. It's all about conformity and molding yourself to the American ethic because America and the West had defeated Hitler and they had defended us and therefore these were the gods we worshipped culturally. And let's submit to their expectations and their cultural mores. And modern orthodoxy saved orthodoxy in Western civilization because it provided people with an orthodoxy that allowed them to maintain this presence in the general culture while still practicing orthodoxy in some cases in a feeble fashion. Rabbanim knew that if they would demand that everyone eat a shear of matzah, no one would eat matzah. Everyone's enjoying a nice spring. You're going to sit there and stuff your face with matzah. So eat a little piece of matzah. It's not a shear of a kazais, but Someone told me a very famous story. They grew up in Queens, which is a large Jewish community in New York, and they went away for the summer in the 60s. And they came back and they were pushing their carriage, their baby carriage, down Main Street, which is the large street that cross-sects or dissects the Jewish community. And everyone started looking at him. Why are you pushing your carriage? It's Aser on Shabbos. There's no Erev in those days. And they said, oh, we forgot. You were away for the summer. The summer is when the rabbi told us the laws of Shabbos that we shouldn't push the carriage. There were Orthodox rabbanim who were simply consciously allowing things to slip, just trying to calibrate how much can people accept while still protecting the overall enterprise of Orthodoxy. I remember I was once I was friendly. I befriended a real arch, zealous Haredi Talmud Chacham in Israel. I would spend Shabbos with him. I would walk into the room, okay? I would be wearing a kippah. I don't think I'd be the classic Dati Lomi kippah, you know, with the train tracks around the side. Not a kippah I was wearing now, but it was really big. Okay, let's say the Rabbi Yossi Ramon kippah, you know, that big classic Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein kippah. And the first thing when I'd walk into the room, he'd say, where's your kippah? Where's your yarmulke? Not because he didn't see it, because in his mind, that wasn't legit. You're not wearing a hat, you're not legit. Baruch Hashem, our relationship evolved. I never really lashed out, never really retaliated. By the end of his life, we're very, very close. Why am I telling you this story? Because I once met someone who used to daven in this person's shul when he was a rabbi in America in the 50s. And they told me, oh, you know that rabbi? I used to be part of his shul. I got an aliyah in his shul for my bat mitzvah. A woman said, you received an aliyah in his shul for your bat mitzvah? And he's telling me I'm not firm enough because I'm not wearing a hat? Are you kidding me? Then I met someone else who says, oh, you know that rabbi? I was the chazan in his shul 1 year for Yom Kippur. I was chazan every year for Yom Kippur. And 1 year I refused to be the chazan because they had installed a microphone. I don't mean a tzomet microphone. I mean a real microphone. And the point is, people had to smoke and mirrors, magic shows, just so Orthodoxy could survive. It was on the ropes. It's a very different Orthodoxy than the robust, vibrant, exciting, advanced Orthodoxy that you all grew up in, that you all were beneficiaries of with Torah and Shiurim and Sam. You know what I did for my summer? I can't tell you what I did for my summer in the 70s, but it was not the Marasha Kollel, not the NCSY Kollel, not Bnei Akiva. I was far from it. Far from it. I remember reading a tshuva. I wanted to read the famous tshuva of Moshe Feinstein about opening cans of food because it's very speculative. It's very vague because we don't really have packaged food is less than 80 years old. 200 years ago, I don't have packaged food, cans of food. You went out, prepared your food, ate it, and threw it out. No refrigeration. The whole sense of packaging and opening packages. I remember I was once the rabbi in Camp Hask, which is a camp in America for special needs children. So I had to issue a lot of very, very intricate halachic positions about medical treatment and traveling to hospitals. And I announced at the beginning of the summer, I will handle whatever questions you throw my way out to the best of my ability. There's one question I won't answer for anyone this summer. Can you open a carton of milk on Shabbos? Because there is absolutely no historical halachic precedent for it. The only halachic precedent I can give you is what the Gemara says. You're not allowed to open a barrel of wine with a spigot, but you are allowed to take a sword and slice off the top of the barrel. Because when you slice off the top of the barrel, you're not making a nice opening. When you put a spigot, you are. So if anyone has a barrel of wine, I'll tell you, don't chop it off with your sword. I'll chop it off with your sword, don't put a spigot. Everything else is up for grabs. I remember I used to be the head waiter in a firm camp in North America, Camp Monk, and the head counselor was a Rav, prohibited us from opening the milk cartons on Shabbos. And I was head waiter, so it was important for me to know this. So the chief learning rabbi, who was himself a big Talmud Chacham, told me, bring all the milk into the kitchen, I'll open it for you. Because it's a little hard to know. So I'll tell you my personal opinion. I'm not going on certain things, but I can't state with conviction and veracity. It's us, it's mutter. So I wanted to finally read Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuva, which tends to make things usher. Can't open this, can't open that. So I read the tshuva, and stage by stage, he's matir, and I'm somewhat surprised. This is not the famous tshuva of Rav Moshe that I heard about, that he asked is opening this and opening that. Until I got to the end of the tshuva, in which he says, even though it seems like it should be mutter, I'm going to claim and decree that it's usher because no one is keeping Shabbos in America, and we have to try to buttress and reinforce Shabbos observance. No one's keeping Shabbos in America? I
looked at the date. It was written in 1927. In 1927, no one was keeping Shabbos in the halachic form in America. My Zaidi, I mentioned before, told me that in the Frumish Shul in Baltimore, and Baltimore was a firmer city than New York in those days because all the Torah people moved to Baltimore. In the Frumish Shul in Baltimore in 1919, the Yekesh Shul, he started a club. And the club was called the Shomer Shabbos Club. And they handed out little buttons, little pins. They all walked around saying, I am a Shomer Shabbos. I'm a member of the Shomer Shabbos Club. And I asked him, how many people were at the club? He told me, 3. The largest shul in the most Torah-oriented city in North America had 3 people in the shul keeping Shabbos. Because in those days, it was a 6-day work week. And if you didn't show up on Saturday, you had to find, my Zaidi told me, he basically went from job to job to job. The point is, choose to be modern Orthodox or don't choose. But this ridiculing of modern Orthodoxy and Rav Shalom Vaitchik and whatever, it's just so historically blind, as I said before. It took so much more courage for my Zaidi to be Shomer Shabbos in 1919 than anything I'll ever do. And it took more courage for your parents or your grandparents, depending upon how old they are, to walk around in medical school or in public in 1955 or 1960 with a kippah on their head than anything you'll ever do. So even if you feel you want to advance it, and you should advance it, it's a responsibility to advance, not to stay in pat and be stagnant and accept the religion of your ancestors. My greatest dream is that my children outpace me religiously. And your greatest challenge should be to take your parents' traditions and advance them and sharpen them and intensify them. But they're the foundation for everything we're accomplishing. Because Orthodoxy in the 50s and 60s was a condemned religion. Certainly, it didn't even exist in the 20s and 30s in America and in Western civilization. So why am I giving this whole harangue? Because 1967 was a game changer. Not just for Soviet Jewry, but for Orthodoxy across Western culture and Western lands. That is what gave Jews the confidence. Religious expression is always drawn from national pride. When Jews feel pride, we're proud to be Jewish, we're proud to triumphed in this war. We're proud to be back in Yerushalayim. It always is true. Hanukkah, the national pride of the conquest and the military triumph, yields the explosion of Torah Shebaal Peh. It's always true that when Jews feel kum imius in pride, one of their expressions, if you ask me for an omen, that this is redemptive, one of the omens to me that shows this is really Yad Hashem is the fact that there's more Torah being learned today across the world than at any point in 2,500 years since the first Beis HaMikdash. I asked this question of Rav Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, and I asked this question of Rav Shechter, and they each told me for sure, you can't compare. There was never a point in history that even be close, approximated, the spread of Torah. Not necessarily the level, but the spread of Torah. 90,000 people celebrating Torah in a stadium 2 years ago for the Daf Yomi. It's unprecedented. It's unimagined. The world that you grew up in is a post-1967. I didn't grow up in that world. I grew up in the 70s, and it still was evolving. It wasn't popular to be from. It wasn't cool. There weren't options. It wasn't supported. It wasn't in... You had to, like, steal it and scrape it together. The robust, vibrant, confident, successful communities of Orthodoxy that we've been able to construct with palatial batei knesses, an active batei medrash, and incredible communities of Orthodox Jews. The vibrancy and the vitality is all post-67. All of it. And that's what the medrash means, ki'ir shechurba layachtav. The events of Yerushalayim integrate Jews, even if they're not living in Yerushalayim, and change them. It creates a fraternity and a solidarity of influence. You could be a Jew living in Moscow or in Siberia. You are integrated and hotwired to the events in Yerushalayim, and it affects your life. Your lives were changed by events that happened 35, 40 years before you were born. The world you were raised in is a post-1967 world. So when you say Hallel, think about that. Think about the world you grew up in. And I'm trying to make it real for you. It's very different than you. I'm just one generation removed from you. I didn't grow up in that world. You were the beneficiaries. You were privileged. I didn't have that. Because I lived too close to 67. And the world was still evolving. Those are the 3 layers of Yom Yerushalayim. and to be able to process it in real terms, not just in vague, we're celebrating Yerushalayim. Number one, military victory. If you want, go on YouTube over the weekend, or tonight, or just YouTube a couple videos, Six-Day War, Return to Yerushalayim, those grainy videos, marching into Yerushalayim, the walls being shot up, Matigor striding through Yerushalayim, that famous picture with the paratroopers. Read, if you want, a couple sections of like Dreamers. Just think about that. Well, forget Yerushalayim. Forget anything that happened beyond just the Six-Day War. And then as redemptive and religious Jews, think about the connotations of Yerushalayim, returning to the biblical homeland, and liberating the Harabayas, and what it means to grow up. And think about living in Gush Etzion in a way that I'm sure you've thought about this year, but I hope you think about it with a little more pride, not in any way a condescension to those boys who are and girls who are studying elsewhere, but I would hope and think that at some level you take pride having spent this year in Gush Etzion. And don't be mistaken. Your presence here, you're not serving in the army yet, some of you may, you're not doing Shemirah, but Gush Etzion has morphed into the community that it is in large part because of this yeshiva. And in large part because of overseas people have come to this yeshiva and have established Gush Etzion as a community built by Olim in ways that unfortunately, and I say this very, very delicately, Gush Katif wasn't. Part of what surprised many people in Israel during the expulsion from Gush Katif is that the opposition wasn't as fierce. The protests weren't. It took a long time for people to protest. A lot of us wondered, and certainly internationally, Jews across the world weren't as locked into the anti-expulsion protests and movements as they were in some others. It wouldn't be the same if similar attempts were made to hand Gush Etzion back, because the amount of Americans, Brits, Australians, South Africans, non-Sabras who live here has created a consciousness of Gush Etzion internationally that didn't exist in Gush Katif. And was very much expressed this past summer as it was intensified and augmented, but was expressed when the tragic events happened in Gush Etzion. Gush Etzion has a place, as Yerushalayim does, obviously, in the international consciousness that other places don't, and in part because so many Anglo-Saxons have populated Gush Etzion, have built communities that reflect their expectations of standard of living. These aren't communities that are populated by caravans and wastelands, but clean paved streets and nice shuls and community services and garbage collection in ways that people that come from those backgrounds expect and are accustomed to. And that whole process of building the Gush that you've all lived in and spent time in, and Neve Daniel and El Azar and Efrat and Rami Levi and English Cake, there's a direct line between people that have spent time in Gush Etzion throughout the last, in Yeshivat Har Etzion, throughout the last 45 years, and what Gush Etzion has become. Because if this yeshiva weren't here, Gush would not be what it is today, the broader Gush. That should be obvious to you after the events of the last month in Rav Lichtenstein's Patira, and seeing how the whole community was in convulsion. So you're not holding a gun, you're not standing at an army post, and you're not protecting Alon Shvut, but you're part of that process. And 100 years from now, or in your lives, 50 years from now, I hope you'll be proud to look back and say, I spent a year in Gush Etzion. I didn't shoot any terrorists, I didn't build any settlements, but I spent a year in Gush Etzion as part of thousands of people that flocked through this yeshiva and put their flag down in this country and in this region. Just as a cute little story to end this year, I remember when I was in Gush Etzion, the yeshiva, in 1984, one day Rabbi Liebtag comes into the Beis Medrash and says, we're starting a new yeshiv. Who can come help? I said, I'll be happy to. So I grabbed the gun, an M16, and we were guarding a new little outpost that they were building near Hebron that Jews wanted to settle. And we had tents and generators and cold schnitzel. We just spent Shabbos there, a rainy Shabbos, guarding the area. Today, that little outpost is called Kar Metzor. The little city near Hebron has about 7,000 people that live there. Have you ever seen the carpenter of the yeshiva with that long beard, Yeshua Berlin? He walks there on his car. He lives there. Rabbi Liebtag started to live there, then he moved back. So you never know. You never know how just simply being one hand, front row seat to history, makes you a participant in history. And I hope that, especially those of you that are spending next year, thinking about spending next year, it's obviously about the learning, it's obviously about the growth, but this means inserting yourself into the historical process rather than sidelining yourself and just going through your life, which you'll attend to, but these are the times to be part of history. Okay, have a happy Yom Yerushalayim, everyone. Hopefully this can give you a little bit of a baseline.